and welcome to another episode of Game Changers. So I am blessed today to have yet another member of industry who is willing to talk to me and Game Changers and everyone out there. So I'm so super happy to welcome Megan to Game Changers. Hi, Megan. If you could give everyone kind of an idea about yourself and what you do, that would be amazing, and then we'll start off.
I do so many things. I'm very, very happy to be here, but I have been in the video game industry for about 15 years, and I focused mostly on marketing. So I got my start at a market research firm called Nico Partners, where we focus specifically on the markets of China and Southeast Asia. Nico Partners has grown since then, and they're doing incredible stuff. From there, I started getting more into publishing. I worked with Serenity Forge, helping them as marketing manager and then publishing manager. I worked with Hooded Horse as the director of operations and supported some of the marketing activities there. And right now I am the head of marketing at Astrological. We publish systems and strategy games that don't hate you. So Astra has had an interesting background. As a publisher, we spun out from the Astra Games Fund, which was started as a more nonprofit philanthropic effort to broaden the reach of what was then considered Thinky Game. The Astra Games Fund is backed by Karina Initiatives, which is a philanthropic entity that wants to encourage children from different backgrounds to embrace the beauty of mathematics. So we are a mission-driven publisher. Astra Games Fund then spun off into Astrological. We are a for-profit publisher, and we focus exclusively now on systems and strategy titles. Our goal is to encourage creative thinking and aha moments and bring these titles that, if you think about systems and strategy games, Civ 7 just came out this week, big deal. A lot of these titles previously, you might have a picture in your mind of who the historical audience may have been. We are intending to bring these games to more people, a more diverse audience. We do not saw off the edges of the content that we provide. Like, the games that we are publishing still have tremendous depth to them and challenge, but we want these games to be available for more people. To do that, we have a different design ethos. Like, we believe in the transparency of information within the games and helping people discover their paths to emergent thinking within these titles. And we are a niche publisher in that regard, where we're focusing on this genre. We want to have a portfolio where we have a game launching tomorrow called Dawnfolk. That is a minimalist survival city builder. We want someone to say, oh, I loved Dawnfolk. I think I also want to check out this next title by Astra, and keep going through and ultimately supporting our investor with their mission to bring math, making it more accessible and approachable without using those words. A lot of people will relate those back to being easier, and our games are not easier. But we want more people to think, this game could be for me. There's different representation here. This was made for me to check out. So that was a really long answer.
That was a great answer. Can I ask a really stupid question? Because that's my job.
Always.
Sweet. Yeah. Oh, already we know what my role in this conversation is. So I don't really play strategy games, though I do have a colleague who immediately I thought of when he said that a new game was launching. Do strategy games tend to hate us?
Mm. I think a lot of strategy games previously, and I think this applies to many games previously, have been developed by a smaller cohort of people that doesn't necessarily represent the people playing them now. And we need more perspectives, and we need more diversity in the people who are playing them. So when it comes to strategy games, I think there are great examples of games. One of the easiest outside of strategy is Dark Souls, Elden Ring. Those games hate you. And within strategy, a few examples.
You don't have to name names. I'm just curious.
Yeah, but they're good examples. Dwarf Fortress and Astronauts are titles published by Kid Fox, and I think they kind of hate you. Tanya is the leader of Kid Fox, and I adore her, and I like these games, but they are games that kind of hate you a little bit. We want to support with more thorough tutorials and helping people feel like they have more transparent information. Dwarf Fortress is notorious for the steep learning curve, like EVE Online. I don't know that it's necessarily the strategy games have hated people. There have just been plenty of video games that hate people, and that is for some people. My partner really enjoys Dark Souls. I don't understand that, but I support them. And I understand that that is appealing for plenty of players. We are trying to bring these games to more people.
It's really interesting because that's a conversation I have with my game students quite a lot, which is, you know, not everyone is as versed in games as you are. They have not, you know, they might be, say, me, who took up gaming a lot later than my students have, you know, that it wasn't something that I did. It wasn't a generational thing. It wasn't a money thing in our house. You know, it wasn't something we did. So I'm on a learning curve, and I'm one of the people who, obviously, I have to learn the affordances, and I have to learn these things that they've all grown up with and immediately understand and throw all these really hard elements into their games. And you're sort of there going, yeah, but someone, think about those people who maybe haven't played tons of this type of game before. Think about people who are maybe new to gaming. There's a whole audience out there that isn't you.
Changing rapidly, and game literacy is such a controversial thing, like what you said. New people are entering games all the time, and I can throw out plenty of titles and talk about things because I've played games for a long time. But then again, even just yesterday, someone sent me the title of a game that has done astonishingly well, and I've never heard of it. I don't know anything about that genre. Yeah. I don't play horror games. I don't know. This is, game literacy is uniquely weird, and I think it's very important to keep in mind, because when you think about books and you think about movies and you think about other forms of entertainment that are published, there's not the barrier that you encounter with games. You have to get good. You have to be good at a game to keep playing it and understand the inside jokes. And you need to, I'm sure there is a world of literacy to fighting games that will never be available to me, because I will not put personal time and energy into understanding it. Because it's not like you watch and sit down and watch a movie and the movie says you have to press some buttons now, if you would, like, at the right time in order to keep watching the movie. There are active barriers that make gaming quite weird. It is this unholy blend of art and tech. I'm always amazed by developers who get anything accomplished, because it's just hard. For Astro, we're very dev first, because publishing is we have we have the slightly easier job in my mind. I think it's hard in plenty of people's mind, but to me, the hard part is making a game, and more importantly, making a game with an audience in mind.
That's always the key, isn't it? Like, who are you making this for? And again, I'll refer back to classrooms. That's the conversation we have all the time. Who are you making this game for? What are your touchstones? If you have to offer this information to a person who isn't in your head, how will they understand what you're trying to make and what you're working towards and what, you know, conceptually what it's going to look like, how it's going to feel, these sorts of things. And that's a big, and I'm sure that those guys who make the games would say, no, the hard bit is the marketing of it. The hard bit is getting it out there. The hard bit is, you know, running the community and things like that. Because again, it's a specialism thing, isn't it? But if we bring it back to you, if you don't mind, Megan, just for a minute, because obviously the company is fascinating and the fact that a game's coming out tomorrow. So I'd love to dig into, like, not the game, but the idea of, like, how you build up to a release date and stuff. So not that specific game or anything like that, but just that kind of, I think it conceptually everyone knows that the marketing happens, but because of the way our courses are designed, it's sort of like that will be later on and someone else's sort of thing when you're in a company. But looking at your job as head of marketing, how did you get there? What was that pathway in terms of your sort of trajectory through industry? I know you describe being at a certain number of different companies and kind of, but I mean, was marketing your first passion, or was gaming your first passion, or was it you did something completely different and actually found your way in? Because the squiggly career is always something that fascinates me, and so many of us have them, and I'm just sort of super interested in what the pathway was to where you are now.
I will interject. I want to come back to this, because I will argue from the beginning of a game, marketing is always there. Whatever type of game you're making, whatever, like, it is baked in. I think what people tend to think of marketing is they think of promotions, but everything from the beginning goes back to marketing, and I'll expand about that a little bit more. Okay, so Megan Carricker. Hi. I have jumped around. When I was very little, we had a big TV in the middle of the dining room, and I could care less what TV shows were on, but if a commercial came on, I was glued. I've always been fascinated in marketing. I like to say that I was going to go to college for psychology, but I wanted to use my powers for evil instead of good. I think it is fascinating to try to understand what other people do with their money, with the decisions, with the time. We all have 24 hours in a day, and trying to understand other people better. I think a lot of this comes back to empathy. I think a good marketer needs empathy. But anyway, so for my career, I knew from a pretty early age that I was very fascinated with advertising. I really loved commercials. I loved looking at ads in magazines. I'm weird in that regard. But I also grew up, I have a sister who got her first Game Boy. She got a Fat Boy Game Boy, and I wanted one very badly. I loved games from an early age. In my mind, I could see, how do I put this? A lot of people my age wanted to grow up to be like an athlete or a movie star. I'm thinking statistically, there aren't enough slots for however many people who want to do that.
I love that you were thinking statistically even when you were young.
I mean, I'm just a nerd. I'm a weird person, and I'm comfortable with that.
No, I just love that. You're 10 and you're like, I've worked out that there are only so many star jobs out there.
Yeah, it just doesn't, the math doesn't. I came from a really small town in North Carolina in the United States with fewer than 8,000 people. It's like, this doesn't work. And at an early age, I had read some book from the library, and I was like, I want to be an anthropologist when I grow up. I was also like, I don't think there are that many anthropologists out there. but I could see the same with games. Everybody loves games. Everybody loves books. Everybody loves these industries that I now lovingly think of as passion tax industries, because a lot of people do love them and want to get in. And we're seeing this. I speak from a position of great privilege on this talk right now because of the hemorrhaging happening in the industry right now, the tens of thousands. I know so many very fantastic people who have they've been ousted from this space. I'm still here somehow. But I knew if I was going to get into games, I'd have to get in a different way. And I love marketing and I love business. And so that was what I always had in mind. I was not going to go down the game creator route. Also, I am one of the only people I know in this industry that doesn't want to make a game. Like,
Because everyone wants to make a game.
everybody wants to make a game, and I completely respect and admire that. That is not something I have ever wanted to do.
But do you
That
know what?
doesn't.
That's nice. It's nice to find your place.
Yeah, I like running meetings and I like thinking about the marketing. Like, I like the things that most people in this space don't. I feel like, but I knew I wanted to come in sideways. And so I was very conscious early on. I got my first job at GameStop when I was in high school. I knew that that would help give me at least a little bit of an understanding. And it did when I interviewed for my internship with Nika Partners. I could lean on that and say, look, I've already been, organizing games on shelves for consumers and getting a better firsthand understanding. And that those stepping blocks have helped me get to the spot that I am in now with publishing, where I didn't realize early on that publishing was what I really did want to be doing. Because I'd also, while I worked with Nika Partners, I also did other jobs. I worked with social media marketing agencies and got a better understanding there. I have been a fractional CMO for e-commerce companies in the sustainable consumer packaged goods space. Like, I love doing lots of things, and I love pulling and connecting dots from different spaces. The amount of knowledge that I brought from e-commerce to the role that I have now and have previously, like, there's so much I think the games industry can and should learn from other spaces. But yeah, so my path was kind of, I was very cognizant pretty early on. Not everybody, a lot of people want to make a game. I think I would like to be in the games industry. I'm going to come in from a different angle, marketing first, then games, which has worked really well for me.
Seems that way.
I'm quite happy here, but when I think about the path that I've taken, I hear a lot of people who are still in games have had weird paths. I tell you what, if anybody's listening though, and if you like accounting or finance, like, that is a great path to consider. Like, that there are always, like, there are some steep needs to still be fulfilled, where it feels like there's just, like, trying to find those sorts of people within the games are it's still tricky. Release managers, people who are very, very, very organized and diligent, and like, there are some roles that are still, I can't speak to what the technical ones that are hard to fill,
No,
but
but I was going to say, just like with a view to that, to it's a little bit like, so my background comes from film studies and sound, and it's sort of like with film studies, like no one wants to be the sort of the pre-production manager, because that's a lot of organization and that's a lot of paperwork.
absolutely.
Everyone wants to be behind the camera. No one wants to do sound because of the boom holding, and you can screw everything up with sound. It's interesting where these opportunities actually do lie in those areas that actually might not immediately be at the forefront of someone who is interested in accountancy and organisation and those sorts of things. They might not think that game is then for them because, oh, everyone makes games. They have to know how to work Unreal or Unity or like these sorts of things. But it's super interesting that you're saying, actually, there's quite a lot of other avenues that are underserved at the moment and yes. sort of pathways in. So just with that pathways in kind of thing in mind, before we get back to, and this will bring us back round to the point you made about marketing being sort of a thing that's essentially a baked in element throughout the sort of the pipeline, is if you were sort of giving someone advice who was currently doing a marketing course or was interested in marketing and wondered about game, what could they do for their portfolio to be able to kind of, you know, walk in and actually give a good account of themselves as someone who could possibly be a part of a marketing team within a game company? That's a bit of a sort of
a brain a little bit
difficult question.
I'm trying to what could they do? I think I've done a lot of hiring over the past 15 years. One of the best things to see is being proactive.
Perfect.
It's thinking about, well, there's a level of respect and being polite and being communicative, but not overdoing it. Mm-hmm. If you were trying to get into a specific role, but being proactive. And one of the things I used to do, this will date me, but like when I was working with the social media marketing agency during some of my spare time, I would think about some of the trending hashtags at that time and think about, I would get very upset because a lot of the, like, I think it would cost $100,000, $200,000 to get a promoted tweet hashtag going. And it was very clear that at the space the games industry was 10, 15 years ago, there was a very severe disconnect between business marketing and the game developers. I would like to think that that gap has closed significantly, but it used to be you'd go to E3 and you could tell the suits from the devs very clearly. But one thing that helped me better understand was just thinking, right, if I was working on this game, if I was thinking through marketing, what would I do differently? What would I explore? If I had a budget, if I didn't have a budget, what could I do?
Nice.
And this ties back to the point that I wanted to make earlier. Marketing can be completely useless in games.
Oh, wow. Okay. Heck, I didn't see that one coming.
Right? no pressure, Megan.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. A lot of it, it's the same with e-commerce. It's the same with other spaces. If the product isn't good, what can you possibly do? And so with games, one of the single biggest and most important thing I can do and support on behalf of Astra as a publisher is the selection of the games that we publish. That's the biggest thing, because as a publisher, we are with our mission-driven emphasis of helping more people reach these types of titles, we have to think about the cross-marketing potential between our games. But marketing is amplification. It's optimizing and amplification. Marketing cannot save a game.
No.
No,
especially with such vocal communities out there as well. So it's not like games are released to a vacuum, is it? And everyone plays in a vacuum. It's not like that at all. Everyone plays in an amplified space to start with, in terms of that they will go on community boards. They will make their opinions known. So that's a really interesting kind of point to make, in terms of that idea that the game itself has to be solid and has to be a saleable product to the people that you're aiming that product at, with a view to that sort of marketing journey. So I wrongly, and you corrected me, placed marketing in, because in my head that's where it lives at the end, where when the game comes out, except for when I talk to students and I'm talking about their GDD and I'm like, style the GDD because this is part of the journey. I honestly truly, I'm like, there's a stylistic tone that I want to see creeping all the way through the product. Yes. But I did what everyone does and go, marketing appears at the end. That's when we sell the game.
Promotion appears at the end.
In my head.
Distribution. Yeah. No, I don't think it's
there
wrong.
There it sits. You're completely right. Because A, you do it for a living. B, you know more than me. But C, of course it's baked in all the way. So can you give us an idea of flavor? Because again, our students are learning to make the games. They are the people who want to make the games. That is their goal, and their joy is to create those games that will then hopefully be picked up and distributed and marketed in that form, if that makes sense, promoted. Can you give me a bit of an idea about where you see marketing within the sort of the pipeline and the journey of a game through its development, as well as then, you know, its final kind of push at the end for publicity and awareness raising?
Fabulous. Absolutely. Like, that's, I mean, this is because Astra's a niche publisher. This is like the scouting is just that is the single biggest marketing decision we can make, is, and that's why I say it has to be baked into the beginning. You have to think about the target audience. You have to think about comps. Comps are very critical in publishing. Pointing to other games that have succeeded or failed, what makes your game like them, what makes them different, and then delivering on it, that's, I think, the hardest part. But marketing comes in from the very beginning, where what kind of game are you intending to make, and where does it live in the realm of other games like it or not like it? Sometimes having no comps at all can be really fantastic, where you're like, this is unique and this is very cool. Most people think of marketing in terms of promotion or community building, and I think that's completely fair too, but that is a little bit later, and it can be an uphill battle if you have made decisions early on in your GDD that, like, if you are entering an oversaturated market, you have to think, I think this is the worst part that people don't like. You have to think about this from a business perspective. These are businesses. There are plenty of people who succeed with a title as a passion project. I had the great honor of getting to help support the launch of Manor Lords with Hooded Horse. And that is one solo developer, Greg, who worked on a game that he wanted to see for 7 years. And that's a happy ending. You see that same for Stardew Valley. Eric wanted to make Harvest Moon when that IP was not successfully coming to the West in a way that, like, he felt like he could do it better. You definitely have people who have been like, I'm making this game for me. And it turns out a lot of other people want that game. From a publishing perspective, that's not what we can think about. Like, that's, like, we're not picking, like, games that are just for us. That would kill our business. We are thinking about how do the games couple with each other? How does the player overlap? There is a really marvelous resource. If anything I've said is interesting, please check out Game Discover Co. Simon Carlos has created this. There is a free component to it. He's been doing marvelous work now for years. And it gives you the ability to see some basic generalizations from games. Like, horror games tend to make bank, or puzzle games are really oversaturated and hard, or specific RPG like realms are underserved or others are overserved, etc. You have to think about these things if you're in it to make money. If you're not, that's a different story. And then if you're joining like a AAA or larger studio, you have to be on board for whatever they're picturing for that end user or player. But like a really, really fantastic example for us recently is we announced a game Modulus in December. And we're a relatively new publisher, and we see an opportunity in more automation games. And Modulus, the premise of it is it's a Zen automation game, similar to Shapes. I don't know how to say that to emphasize the Z, Shapes. But it's you get to cut, color, stamp, and assemble your own 3D building blocks. There's a lot of math to it, and there's a lot of creative problem solving. And within a month, we had over 40,000 wish lists, which wish lists are a common metric right now for understanding the velocity or interest in a title.
I wish list lots of games.
Yeah, and some people never use that feature,
I wish
which
list the
is.
heck out of games.
But there are people that have never, like, they've used Steam for years and they've never, they're like, what is this feature?
Oh my gosh,
What?
no. I'm all over it, like a rash.
Yeah, that is a common key performance indicator right now is what are your wish lists? Modulus is a great game. I can already say that we knew the team developing it. They had created You Suck at Parking. They're experts at the aesthetic and the vibe and gameplay. They know what they're doing. We knew what they had in mind. They're rocking. And so that makes it from my role, from head of marketing and the marketing people that we have to then amplify it. Okay, we have attention. What do we do now? What other tactics can we explore? A brilliant example of utilizing this effectively recently has been Balatro. That's a game that Playstack has just done phenomenally with recognizing there's an opportunity here. How do we keep doing more with a great game?
It's just funny
And so
because
that's.
all of my students told me about it. They were all obsessed. And I was like, poker game, please. So I bought it and I'm obsessed.
I think that's the worst. There's Chris Z, How to Market Your Game. Like one of the best marketing pieces of advice he gives is have a good game. And I think that's so hard. Like my heart goes out to developers. What makes a good game? I don't know. I can't offer advice on that. I don't know. I
I mean,
can't
I
make
probably
games.
should be able to say some things,
I
but the
in
thing is,
practice.
you've got to take into account that target audience, and also like you've said, and it's amazing that you've actually said it, because again, it's one of those things where when you're teaching people, you'll say the thing, and then someone from industry will say the same thing, and they go, "Oh, person from industry said this," and you're like, "I've been saying
That's like when you're having an argument with your partner and someone else says it, and you're
Someone
like,
else, and you're like, oh, how dare you take that stranger's
that
point of
never
view?
happened. But
yeah, that idea of it not just appealing to you, but also kind of carrying the ethos of the studio or carrying the ethos of the developer. And it's something that we do try and kind of discuss quite a lot, is you're not making, in a general way, you're not making a game for yourself. You pointed out some really specific examples of people who kind of have, and it worked out for them, and that's fabulous. But a little bit like when you were younger and you were kind of calculating how many sort of stars there were that were available, it's a similar kind of calculation, isn't it? Like how many single maker, literal individual person making a game can be super successful, and it must be super low numbers. It's got to be.
That you don't hear about all of the people failing. It's the
No.
same sort of it's a survivorship bias. Like you don't hear of all of the people who've put their life savings into a game that didn't work out. And it happens more often than not. And it's the same thing for making new businesses. Making a new business is extraordinarily hard. Most new biz I think it's something like less than a third of new businesses survive their first year. And I think like, it just it's there's a lot of comparables with other industries like We're not that special. In some regards,
no,
you're making
it
a product.
Feels special. You have
to... Yeah, and that's why I think for Astra, like we, that's why the tutorial, the beginning, when you enter this game, that's, I think, one of the hardest pieces for any game ever, ever. Because first off, you're making this game, you're pouring so much of your heart and your energy and your brain into it, and you get too close. You get really, really, yeah. really close. Mm-hmm. Having to step back and have someone else try it and they're not getting it, it's very easy to be like, oh, they're dumb. They're just dumb. Like, I'm brilliant. They don't get it. Having to have that empathy of view your game for the first time over and over and over and think through that while also juggling the mid game to the late game and certain types, like, it's so hard. It's like 4D chess of just, you have to hold all of these different things in your mind at any given point. I think it's incredible the work that game developers do. So, but I will reiterate any point here, marketing has to be from the beginning. It has to be, like, you have to think about this in your GDD. You have to think about what other games are out there. It breaks my heart how many titles I see pitched that I just know they're not going to find an audience. They haven't thought through it. It hurts. And so please, for your dear friend Megan, just take a minute. Think about it. Think about if this is like who else will play my game. And that's why I strongly recommend checking out, signing up for the Game Discover Code newsletter. Because the work that Simon and Moore and Abby and the team there are doing with regards to enlightening more people about some of the business and math behind this. They have great tools like an affinity chart on the back end where you could see, all right, the people who are playing this title might also be enjoying these titles.
Nice.
It's just very powerful, great information to be tracking and seeing. Because then with the publishing, then we get into some of the tricky things of timing and events and marketing beats. In short, there is a lot of complexity. That's my roguelike deck builder game that I play of, like, I have this card. We have release date timing. We have a demo. We have these cards. When are we going to play these cards? Will I have more of these cards? Is this a one-time use card? Can I, like, what can I do? That's the game that I love. This, I think marketing is a strategy game, and I love it, but I am quite odd.
But it's from the way that you're describing it, it's something that the creatives have got to get on board with and have as a long-term strategy that then follows through to the publicity. And you're part of knowing when you're going to drop the game, knowing what elements are going to come out and when, and how to build that interest and those elements. And those resources that you were talking about, I'll link them on the episode for anyone who's listening, because obviously it's out there and it's information that's useful, and people can start kind of conceptualizing where their game potentially fits and what the competition is and where it might be. So that's a super useful thing to know.
In regard to competition, I will say the indie game space is the most collaborative and friendly space. It is so nice. I've heard of horror stories from, like, the wine industry where people would go to a conference and have to cover their table with a blanket because other people just actively try to steal things.
Oh my gosh.
Within games, I'm happy to tell you right here some of the things that are pivotal to Astra's approach as a publisher. And I think AAA gets a little bit different. I think it's a little bit higher stakes, cutthroat. But within indie space, everybody's very friendly and willing to share because we all love games.
Yeah.
Like, I love games. I've been watching Civ 7 this week because I love Civ. It's one of the coolest feelings to work on a title and then meet someone who helped develop it or publish it. And I will, one caveat to what you said From the publisher perspective, I will say this is very important. These are very important things to think about and consider from the beginning of your game. If you are solo developing or small developing on a small team, or more importantly, if you're self-publishing, if you partner with a publisher, you will have to let go.
Yeah, there is that. Let go of the baby.
You have to, like, that's part of the deal. You have to trust that the publisher, and historically publishers get a very bad rap. We will make decisions that are disagreeable in some perspectives. Like, we will do things that may result in more click-throughs for key art that might be disagreed upon by the, like, we support the baby, but we're in this co-parenting path. We will make decisions that might not necessarily be agreed on, and if dev funding has been supplied, and depending on the terms of the contract, like that gets to be difficult to navigate for some developers, which I understand. Like that could be hard. Like, you're like, I know the audience for my game, I have this picture, and if you agree and sign to a publishing deal, like, it might be that the publisher sees something different.
It's the kill your darlings thing, and what I mean by that is just being able to let go of some of the stuff. So when someone's put heart and soul into a game, and you come along, and I mean this as a teacher or as someone who's producing, and you go, actually, you know what? That's not going to be in the game now. I understand that kind of that holding on to and wanting all your hard work in inverted commas to kind of be demonstrated and visible, but sometimes for the greater good. These
It's like
decisions have to
director's
be
cuts.
made.
That's why they exist.
That's it. Yeah. And the producer's cut and the all of those sorts of things. With a view to kind of that overall the idea of putting games out there, there's another side to your interests and what you look at as well. So it's not just putting the games into the world, but it's the sustainability around those games and kind of what it means for climate change and these ideas that we don't always think about when we think about entertainment industries. So there are obviously things around entertainment industries that encourage environmental practices that are positive and kind of impact in a minimal way on the environment. But I know that you are in a special interest group concerned with climate change attached to the gaming industry. And I wondered if you'd mind talking a little bit about that as well, in terms of just it's not something we talk about a lot, I don't think. I know it never, I very rarely does it pop up in my LinkedIn or my Instagram. So can you give us an idea about just in general, what is the impact of the game industry on the climate?
Yes, the answer is yes.
Yes,
Sorry,
yes,
this
it
is the
does.
short answer.
Yes.
Yes, there is an impact. I have not been as active in the special interest group. So there's an entity called the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA, and the group is the Climate SIG, the Special Interest Group. I have not been as active because I had another baby, which tends to make life harder. I was previously very active in the IGDA Climate SIG and the Game Devs of Color Expo, because I believe there should be more conversations about sustainability and diversity within this industry. With sustainability in particular, there are many different ways you can think about the impact, but I think one of the most impactful impact things to consider if you are creating a game is, I had a lot of great conversations with Paula Esquadra, who is currently a researcher at Microsoft with an Xbox's division, I believe. It's the behavioral nudges, the impact of what you are doing within a game. So, like, there, Dr. Ben Abrams, he is an expert on what are the technical costs of developing games in terms of electricity and hardware, and those pieces, like our generation, our life cycle upgrades on going from PS4 to PS5. Like, what are the costs associated there? And the little costs of running a team. software engineers are extremely expensive for the environment, like as a career, just in general. But in my mind, one of the most interesting facets for entertainment fields, when you think about games, when you think about books, when you think about movies, what are the decisions that you can make and how do these things affect how you view the world? So one of the things that I did for a while was I would stream what I considered eco-friendly-ish games. Games that in some capacity are affecting what you would consider that could then be transferred to real world activity. So a great example of this is Alba by Us2, which is one of the few B Corps in this space. I'm not gonna get into that too much, but they're cool. Alba is a game where you are a young girl and you are on an island, and it's a lot like Pokemon Snap. You're taking pictures of things, but there's little things like one of your objectives is clean up the island, pick up trash. When I go out in the world, I might see trash and pick it up because I did that in Alba. On the flip side, I think an example of a game that's terrible about this that I deeply love is Deep Rock Galactic. You are going to different planets and destroying the native inhabitants and mining out everything you can possibly rip from it. You're throwing flares left and right. You don't care because you're just taking and leaving. Does that have an impact in the real world? Like, these things affect people in weird ways. I can't speak for the numbers and the studies, but they're not. Behavioral transference is a fascinating field that I think there is more that can be done and will be done. I will caution, making a climate first sort of game tends to not go well business-wise. If you're doom and gloom, if you're talking about here's things that you could be doing but the earth is doomed, most people don't enjoy that. there's a weird line there. There's an Earth Day Appreciation Festival coming up pretty soon on Steam that's been run, I think, by Stray Fawn and Slug Disco for a while. There's a few indie publishers doing some great stuff here. But it's an example of, like, your game can either fall in the category to participate of it has to do with nature and Earth and supporting the Earth, or it's like post-apocalyptic dystopian future. It's a weird line, and there's been really interesting things done here. I think Minecraft has done a lot of exploration of how to use Minecraft to teach people about ecosystems and can there be more conscious decisions that I think the moral of my story here is, game developers, you have more power than you realize, and I think it's really cool. And it's the same thing with authors. Authors have more power than they realize of books that, you know, small children read. Like, what you're saying affects people. And I think if you can be if there's an ability to be mindful of that, I think it's really hard because there's so many other things. Like, would you want to introduce something that could be more positive for the environment, but that makes your game a little less fun? I don't, like, that's a trade-off that, but there sometimes, and usually, there's a concept called the triple bottom line.
Okay.
For businesses exploring this. And usually, when you think about the triple bottom line, hold on, I'm gonna look it up really quick to make sure that I'm talking about it. And it's for people, planet, and profit. So it's an accounting framework where you're thinking through the social, environmental, and economic components of your business. The crazy thing about the triple bottom line is usually what's better for your people and what's better for the environment is also more profitable.
Wow.
Usually, this is a grand sweeping generalization that
I love those, though. They're fabulous. Make one.
Yeah, Megan said it.
Megan said it was better.
Well, it tends to line up that if you take care of your people in a business, and then you also keep in mind the environment in the long term, that this helps your profits and other companies' profits. But it's the same, I think, if people are a little more mindful in games of these components. I think a great example recently is Terra Nil, where they made it fun. They made working through cleaning up and taking care of an ecosystem fun.
And sort of
They're
running
cool.
an ecosystem and just being aware of everything within it. And that idea that you were talking about, the idea of being more impactful than perhaps people imagine. I think if you look at not broadening the types of players, but the idea that games will be played by quite young children, there's an opportunity there because they're quite simple games. They don't need to be, at the level of sort of open world, like full on kind of games. But that idea of being able to introduce those kind of considerations and some of that emotional investment in your environment and everything that's around you, and then kind of having some of those good lessons, it's quite interesting as a sort of a conceptual thing to start being environmentally aware in a slightly different way than I would have thought, because my brain immediately went to electricity consumption, hard drive space, the cloud, because it all costs. And
Yes,
by that I
and
mean
that does.
energy
And
and, resources and things like that. So.
there are great consultants in that space, like Ben, who can tell you and quantify and explain. But I think one overlooked angle is just what story are you telling?
Oh no,
And what is that?
completely. But what I meant was it's where my brain goes immediately is like what the hardware cost is, what's the energy cost, but not to what you were talking about, which is super fascinating in terms of
We're
that
having fun here.
creative
Having a great
space.
time.
I think that's probably our time, Megan, if that's okay. We've chatted around all the things that I was hoping to chat and a lot more, which was fabulous. Thank you so much for taking the time out to do this. I know you don't know me. We were introduced by a kind of an intermediary person who will also be appearing on this podcast in time. But I just want to thank you for your time, Megan. I do really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy to help and keep paying it forward. I know, goodness knows, I have utilized many resources of my career that helped me get to where I am. So keep me posted if there's other ways that I can help in the future.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. And that's Game Changers. Thank you for listening. Please share. Let's get the listenership up and let's make sure that we're hearing all these really interesting elements of the game industry. For now, bye. Thank you.